Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so we will begin. We're going to spend just a few more minutes on Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. We'll finish that up very quickly, and then we're going to move to Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, another very important figure. Just a few things I want to mention. People contacted me about previous classes. Someone pointed out a very interesting website, KarbanPesach.org. That's KarbanPesach.org, and this is relevant to our discussion of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. You can read all about how the Karban Pesach was offered after the destruction of the temple, how the temple is not a prerequisite for bringing the Karban Pesach, etc., etc. So that's KarbanPesach.org. I have here, I'm not going to bother reading it, I meant to read it last week, but I can send it if anyone's interested. It's the letter that I mentioned from Mayor Auerbach of Jerusalem, who speaks about how great it is, that how he says that Tzedakah Asa Kadosh Baruch Hu Imamo, that God has done us a great kindness by not permitting us, that is, by having the non-Jews not permit us to go onto the Temple Mount, because he writes that there'd be also people will be stepping on places they're not supposed to, you'd have arguments, etc. Last week, Rabbi Jonathan Hirsch asked, has there been a biography of Bernard Illowy, who we'll get back to in a minute, and I mentioned that there was an article on him, but not a biography, but it slipped my mind that there actually is a biography of his, although it's not published. It's right here. I have a copy of it. It's a doctoral dissertation by Moshe Sherman. I believe he's in Toro now, and it's entitled Bernard Illowy and 19th Century American Orthodoxy, Yeshiva University, 1991. And if anyone's interested in really the leading Orthodox rabbi in the mid-19th century, you can read about it here. Moshe Sherman also published another interesting book, which I have. It's a source book. It's a biographical source book of American Orthodoxy up into World War II. So it has entries on all the various rabbinic figures. It's got to be about 300 pages, 250 pages, and it's very valuable because the notes, the bibliographies of their writings make it quite worthwhile. And finally, some people emailed me about what I spoke about last class, about Orthodox rabbis being rabbis in shuls without machitzas, or even in conservative shuls. I'm in a town, West Orange, New Jersey, where the rabbi who really built it up from a minion of Shomer Shabbos people into a town now, which probably has about 600, 650 Shomer Shabbos. We have now about five or six shuls. He began his career in a conservative synagogue in Paramus, New Jersey. In fact, Rabbi Avi Weiss, who's my employer part-time at the moment, was telling me just the other day about how, must have been 40 years ago, he worked for Rabbi Marcus in this conservative synagogue in the Hebrew school. And I mentioned last class, and this was in response to what Rabbi Friedman mentioned about some negative comments by a well-known Orthodox figure, and I pointed out, yes, that is correct, Dov. I pointed out that in those days, it was very, very difficult to get a pulpit with a machitza. That wasn't the era, certainly when you left the New York area. And not only that, the yeshivas encouraged their guys. They wanted their guys to go into these synagogues to keep them in the Orthodox fold. So, I mean, to look at these rabbis now, when they were doing what the Rosh Yeshiva, not just of YU, but of Skokie, of Ner Yisrael, I mentioned Emanuel Feldman, of Chavetz Chaim, of Tzar Vadas, were telling them they needed to do, not just for their own parnassas, but to bring these, keep these people in the fold. In fact, there's just to give you an example of a rabbi. There was a rabbi, his name was Yehuda Leib Fuhrer. He was one of the leading students of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and he comes to America and becomes rabbi in Mount Holyoke, Massachusetts. When the Rav went up to Boston, he had a close relationship. Now, Mount Holyoke, the synagogue, becomes conservative, and yet Rav Fuhrer still remains the Rav of the synagogue because they liked him. He was their Rav, although the story is that he really doesn't compare to the other rabbis I was speaking about because they say he never entered the shul again. And on the high holidays, they put in a machitza, but they liked him, and he was still the Rav. He sold their chametz, etc., etc. But that's interesting. Now, but for those who want more on this, we don't have time now, you can look in my little booklet, Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox. on page 14, and I give the statistics here from Jonathan Sarna, that in 1961 there were 250 Orthodox synagogues where family seating was practiced. In 1954, it was estimated that 90% of the graduates of Skokie took non-machitza shuls, and 50% of the graduates of Yeshiva University took them. The RCA was under constant pressure from the Aguda, and they claimed that they only had one-third of Orthodox, of RCA members took these synagogues, which is probably very low. But for the RCA even to acknowledge that one less than a third of the RCA membership had such synagogues, and they included it when it was only in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that's still acknowledging a lot. One out of every three RCA members had these shuls. So it really is, I believe, the worst type of judging from the standpoint we are now, when these synagogues obviously are out of favor and the young generation won't go to them, and judging back to an era when that's what American Jewry wanted, and it took a long time to convince American Jewry that the adage that the family that prays together stays together doesn't necessarily apply to traditional Judaism. Yes, that is true, Rabbi Hirsch. And I wrote about that in my booklet, for those who don't have it, on Saul Lieberman. It's also about this the idea, not the idea, the history, how if you go back to the 20s and 30s and 40s, how conservative and orthodoxy were really very close, and how the changes began to happen, which is what made Lieberman going to the conservatives so much of a blow to the Orthodox, because here he was giving an imprimatur, they thought, in an era when the typical American layperson really saw no difference between an Orthodox synagogue and a conservative synagogue. Like I said, half the synagogues the Orthodox were going to were themselves without machitzas. And don't forget, in those days there was no egalitarianism. You had Orthodox synagogues with microphones too. The sitter was basically the same thing. So you could see that they were very close. And we know about the history, how JTS had negotiations in the 30s to merge with YU, and the real sticking point was Mordechai Kaplan on the faculty. But that's, you're right, that would be a good history. Okay. With that, we will move on. As I said, we're going to finish up very quickly with the Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer and move into Rav Reines. We ended last class talking about this great dispute that was taking place in the mid-19th century in New Orleans, where Bernard Illouis posseled the Moalim from circumcising the children of intermarried of non-Jewish women when they were intermarried. And Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer disagreed. And he thought, and this is where we ended, that not only is it not a sin to circumcise these children, it's a big mitzvah. Why is it a mitzvah? We spoke a little bit. Let's just to summarize briefly again. First of all, Kalischer does not see a problem circumcising the children. In addition, it will make it easier, as we spoke about last class, for them to be circumcised later in life. In an era where there's no anesthesia, a 13-year-old or an 18-year-old is not going to want to be circumcised. But if they're already circumcised and then they turn 13 and they see the religion of their father, it'll be much easier for them to just go to the mikvah, which obviously is no big deal. And Kalischer thinks that this is very important because, as he says, these are holy seeds, Zera Kodesh. And he develops this idea that although halachically the child of a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother is not Jewish, there still is a connection. There's obviously a biological and a physical connection, but Kalischer thinks there's also a spiritual connection, although the halacha prevents there from being a halachic connection, but that's something that we should try to rectify. And we heard last class from Rabbi Friedman how last week in, I guess it was in Montreal, Rabbi Druckmann, who came to speak about his Beis Din, he cites Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer as really providing the model for what they're doing in Israel. In fact, Kalischer mentions, quote, leaders of Israel will sprout from among these people. So he thinks it's a very good thing. In addition, he thinks that this will allow the father's tshuva, repentance, to be complete. Here the father was intermarried, father non-Jewish children. How is he supposed to do tshuva? One of the ways he can do tshuva is to making sure that the children will become Jewish. And the best way to do that is to make it easy for them by circumcising them and showing them that, because at this time the mothers won't allow them to be Jewish, to show them there's a path for Judaism. Are there any traditional sources? Well, you really don't have traditional sources if you're thinking of Rishonim because this wasn't an issue. But I can, if you look at Ritzvi Hirsch Kalischer's tshuva, I think he has two tshuvot. They're actually also discussed in this new book. I say it's new, but it's really a translation, but there's a lot of new stuff by Avi Sagi and Svi Zohar called Transforming Identity, The Ritual Transformation from Gentile to Jew, Structure and Meaning, where they discuss the idea of conversion. And the machlokes, those who are lenient, those who are strict, what does conversion mean? Is it an ethnic idea? Is it an halachic idea? And they have a whole chapter there where they discuss the dispute between Hildesheimer and Kalischer. And Kalischer, he quotes sources in halacha and in Tanakh. He's very original in all his derivations. I mean, the idea of Zera Kodesh, he understands this. He quotes a verse in Ezra, and he understands this to be referring to the children, where apparently the pshat is referring to the men who intermarried. In any event, for those who want more details can see this book, or in Hebrew earlier. Kalischer also says, I mean, he answers the problem that Hildesheimer and others had, Illily had, if we circumcise these children, and they grow up in the community pretty much, or very close to the community, people will assume they're Jews. In fact, there's no question that many of these fathers, once they circumcise them, every Jew knows the big thing for a man to become Jewish is circumcision. You can certainly imagine the ignoramuses in New Orleans and elsewhere, as far as they're concerned, he was circumcised. That makes him Jewish. The fact that there wasn't a basin, the fact that he didn't go in the mikvah, so he goes in the river, he has a bath. I mean, they would regard the children as Jewish, and plenty of the women who later would marry them would regard them as Jewish. So this is a real problem, according to Hildesheimer and Illily. Kalischer doesn't think so. He thinks that you can make it clear, however you do this, either announcements or whatever, that these children, although they're circumcised, they're not completely Jewish. We're waiting for them to be completely Jewish. We want them to become completely Jewish, but at present they're not, and everyone will know that they're not Jewish, and he doesn't see that as a problem at all. And as I said last class, I really think, without knowing it, this has become the practice, at least in America. The typical Moel will go to any house he's called to. He doesn't ask if the mother is Jewish or if the mother was converted by a Reform rabbi or anything. He'll just circumcise any child, and the children then grow up, and we know today that if someone comes from the non-Orthodox world, they're raised, you can't assume they're Jewish, unfortunately. So the fact that they're circumcised really is irrelevant today. It could be different years ago when you only had one community, but I do think today we have a situation just like Ritzvi Hirsch Kalischer, and in my experience has been, we actually, although we don't usually encourage conversion, if someone is raised in a house, even a Reform house, where they believe they're Jewish and they associate with Jews, and we don't discourage them. On the contrary, we try to make it very easy for them to convert. We want them to convert, especially in Israel, which is what they're doing in Israel, because these people live among Israelis. The fact that they're circumcised as babies makes it a lot easier because, as I said, that would prevent some of them from converting. So it does seem that Ritzvi Hirsch Kalischer's position has actually triumphed in our own day. Now, David Ellenson, the president of the Reform Hebrew Union College, who I mentioned last class, has devoted his scholarly life to the study of Orthodoxy. He himself grew up Orthodox, or at least traditional, and is the most traditional of any Reform leader in recent memory. I mean, he's, as far as I know, he's Shomer Shabbos. He when he lived in Los Angeles, he would go to an Orthodox minyan all the time. He discusses this controversy in an article, and he thinks you can explain the different positions by the fact that Illily and Hildesheimer were living in environments, both in Germany for Hildesheimer and in America for Illily, where they were confronted with an environment where traditional Judaism is threatened. They're an embattled minority, so therefore they were building up fences, stringencies, to shore up orthodoxy. No different than we spoke in a previous class about Rav Unterman, who says that when he was in England, he had very high stringencies. I don't want to say high standards. when it comes to conversion. The reason I don't want to say high standards is because you often have people, especially Haredim, they speak about how they have very high standards when it comes to conversion, with the implication that people like Rav Druckman and others don't have high standards, when it's not a question of standards at all. It's just a question of a different halachic approach. When you use the word standards, you imply that the others have low standards. So, for example, when my good friend Rabbi Yonah Ries, now he's head of REITs, he was on the RCA based, and when they made their new standards, he, in an interview in a Jewish Week, he said, "We want to make sure we have high standards." And I don't know. I think they want to make sure they have different standards, because again, that's implying that the other rabbanim, that their standards are low. You could have rabbis whose standards are low, but the case that they were referring to was just a halachic argument, whether how much you have to require for a convert to become Jewish. It's not a question of a high standard or low standard. It's a question of a stringent approach versus a more lenient approach. And there's no notion in our tradition that necessarily a stringent approach is better. Sometimes it's better, but sometimes it's worse. So, no, they're not making it that easy in Israel, and that could be right, that could be wrong, but it's not a question of a higher standards. It's just a question of whether stringency is required. But some believe you need to make it easier. And Rav Unterman, as we spoke about, was one of those who said that in Chutz Laaretz, he had stringencies and he made it very difficult. But when he came to Israel, because you had all these people coming in Aliyah and in Israel, for all the reasons we spoke about, he thought that it was necessary to have a more liberal approach in Israel. Yeah, halacha, you're right. Halacha is like Beis Hillel. Rashi already says that when we say Kocha de Tera Adif, that it's more significant to have a heter because anyone can be stringent. That doesn't mean you necessarily always go the lenient position, but in general, all the great poskim have been known as mekilim. Rav Avram Shapiro pointed this out. Why is that the case? Because great poskim become great simply because they're asked shilas. And if a poskim is always going to be stringent, people are not going to always ask him. So the great poskim in general have tended towards leniencies. Basically, you know, if you have a posek who's always lenient, there's a problem. And if you have a posek who's always strict, there's a problem. With the great poskim, you never know. But in general, they look for leniencies because there's no great benefit in forcing stringencies on people, especially when you have cases like a conversion. Well, the Chazon Ish has a reputation of being stringent. The fact is, Rav Kook was more stringent than him in many areas. The Chazon Ish has many areas where he's lenient. Incredible kulas as well. And the Chazon Ish was the one who made it possible even for the Haredi movement to do Kiruv, because he developed the whole notion that these non-religious Jews are not to be judged negatively. The Chazon Ish had certain shitas, certain stringencies. But you know, at the end of the day, a lot of these stringencies on really don't matter, they don't really affect the personal situation, whether your shiurim are bigger or whether you're a little more strict on a Shabbos law. We're not dealing with every posek who deals with issues of aguna, mamzerus, and the personal things tend towards leniency. The Chazon Ish did tend towards stringencies in the ritual areas, and he's not the first. You had poskim before him. It's interesting is that we were in the 50s and 60s, Orthodoxy was of such a state that all of a sudden people were looking for that. And whereas in previous years they didn't go for that, you had these Torah communities that this is what they wanted, surety, and they turned to the Chazon Ish and they accepted all the stringencies. Whereas the typical community has balabatim. Balabatim don't go for stringencies. But in yeshiva world, people go for stringencies. I think, and maybe I'll write about it one day, that explains the success of the Chazon Ish. He never could have had this success in a community of balabatim. He didn't have the success in Jerusalem. He couldn't have had it in Europe or America, but he could have it in a complete Torah community like B'nai Brak, which then, of course, branches out. In any event, getting back to Ellenson, he argues that Kalischer, who was in Eastern Germany, really it's a Polish type environment, he did not have to deal with these problems. It's a completely traditional environment. And therefore, he's able to have a more open-minded position in terms of circumcising the child, things of that nature, and he develops this. I doubt it, because I'll just point out that in her book, Jody Myers points out that in Kalischer's town of Torn, by 1963, which is 2 years before this debate with Hildesheimer, we already see Collischer complaining about reformers entering the city. For the first time now, you have people who don't close their stores on Shabbos, who are public Shabbos violators. Why this happened is because the railroad reaches Torn in 1857, and that, of course, changes everything. It becomes a different type of city. You now have non-religious living openly in the city. Collischer knew what it meant to live with non-religious Jews in 1865. As a final comment, let me note that Collischer is also significant in that he is one of the few Gedolim who actually showed a concern with Ethiopian Jewry. The first messages, the first news about Ethiopian Jewry begins to come out in the 1860s, 1870s. There were travelers to Ethiopia, and two great rabbis were very encouraging and believed that these were Jews who had to be brought back to the fold. One was Israel Hildesheimer, and the other was his very good friend, Ritzvi Hirsch Collischer. Hildesheimer was really a leader in this, and Collischer wrote to Hildesheimer praising him for his efforts. Now, Collischer's messianic type of Zionism that we discussed the last two classes fell out of favor for many years. In fact, we'll see shortly that Reines's religious Zionism, the Mizrahi form, is very different. At least until 1967, it was very different. And yet, Collischer's Zionism would see a rebirth with Rav Kook. And really, Rav Kook's form only becomes popular, as we know, after 67. In fact, I was happy to see that Jody Myers, in her book, calls attention to Ritzvi Hirsch Collischer's influence on this book, Eim Habanim Smecha, by the great Rabbi Yisachar Teichtal. Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal. I assume we'll devote a future class to him. A Hungarian anti-Zionist posek of the Munkacs variety, who was a polemicist against Zionism, during the Holocaust, sees the error of his ways. And one of the last books published in the war years, in Budapest, in the end of in Tuchshin Gimel, in 1943, he repents for all of his anti-Zionism and comes to the conclusion that the Holocaust is a result of the Jews rejecting the land of Israel and showing God that they didn't care about the land of Israel. Unfortunately, he is martyred in the Holocaust, but the book becomes a classic text for religious Zionists. If you go to Merkaz, you get this edition, which has the footnotes and everything. And the book is devoted to the value of Eretz Yisrael, and Ritzvi Hirsch Collischer's ideas and works play an important role. In fact, I don't think Jody Myers knows this, because she didn't mention it in her book, in which she said that this becomes significant, but had she looked at the beginning, you see that Teichtal describes how there's no rabbis, there's no, you know, he's writing in really the last stages of Hungarian Jewry. He has no one to give his book a haskama. So he says he's going to use the haskamas from the Drishat Zion or Ritzvi Hirsch Collischer, because all he's doing, he says, is repeating what Ritzvi Hirsch Collischer does and clarifying it and elaborating it. And therefore, the great Gedolim, Rav Eliyahu Gutmacher, the great Itzer Rav, and the Rabbi Yeshua of Kutna, the Yeshua Smalko, and Rav Chaim Dozot Chazan, the Sephardic, the Rishon Lezion Yerushalayim, who gave haskamas to Ritzvi Hirsch Collischer's book, he reprints their haskamas to this book and says that their writings are also approbations to his book. Kibbutz Tirat Zvi, one of the most important religious Zionist kibbutzim. I'm sure if you go to your local supermarket, you can get their little knak-knak-iot. Is that how you pronounce it? How do you say hot dogs? Knak-knak-iot, I think. I was there once. I spent Shabbos there. They produce a lot of meat and other things. I'm not sure. It might even be the first religious kibbutz. So I'll have to check on that. It's named after, appropriately, Ritzvi Hirsch Collischer. So with that, we end Ritzvi Hirsch Collischer. If anyone has any questions or comments on Ritzvi Hirsch Collischer, we'll take them for just 5 minutes or so before we move on to Reines. I'll check on this kibbutz Tiratz. Yeah, I'm not sure. I can't remember if it's the first religious kibbutz. Ah, okay. So there we have it. The first Dati kibbutz. And that shows you something. And who's the first Dati kibbutz named after? The man who really inspired it all, who we've spoken about the last two and a half classes, Ritzvi Hirsch Collischer. Okay. So then, Yes, we spoke Yisrael. You'll have to download last week's class. We did speak about his interaction. It was a very troubled interaction. He thought that Hirsch was doing great disservice, even sinning, by his anti-Zionism. And Hirsch wrote back to him, "I'm not the one sinning. You're sinning." So they did not. They were not friends, to put it mildly, and they didn't get along on this whole issue. But I don't want to go into it again. Only now we spoke about it last class.